case is taken under advisement. The sixth case of the day is U.S. against Mitchell. Is Mr. Richards here?
I am.
Mr. Richards, okay, glad to see you here. I hope it, sorry?
Glad to be here.
I hope it was not too disruptive and you've had a busy day. Okay, so I'm familiar with some of those phenomena. Okay. All right. Go ahead, Mr. Mitchell, when you're ready. I'm sorry, Mr. Richards, on behalf of Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Iris. My name is Stephen Richards, and I represent the appellant in this case, Raleigh Mitchell. The issue here, critically stated, and I'm just going to deal with the issue involving the trial court's consideration of Mr. Mitchell's alleged behavior towards his attorneys in fashioning the sentence, is this. Should or can a man be sentenced to life in prison, in significant part because the trial judge perceives that he doesn't get along with his attorneys or exercises his right to counsel of choice, or his attorneys decide that they don't want to represent him? Because that's essentially what happened in this case. It should be noted that the trial judge did not enter the case until after there had been a number of changes of attorneys. If you look at the docket sheet, she first takes over the case just before trial. There are docket sheet entries, which she looked at later, which, of course, she was entitled to do, showing that various counsel appeared, withdrew, some disagreement, apparently, and Mr. Mitchell went through.
How do you get along with him?
I get along with him very nicely. I will tell you, in all honesty, I've never met him in person, but we do correspond.
It's probably easier to get along with my correspondence.
It is certainly possible, and there may be some peculiarity about him I don't know about that maybe creates some difficulty. But that difficulty is a matter, a private matter, and a privileged matter between himself and his attorneys, so that the trial judge's perception of it invaded his right both to choose counsel and to have interactions with counsel.
Did Magistrate Judge Foster then handle the prior, all those changes in counsel?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's clear from the docket sheet. And if you look at what the trial judge says, it's clear that she's just looking at the docket sheet as well as perhaps saying something based upon her personal observation of interactions between Mitchell and his last counsel, Mr. Bratton. But, you know, what those interactions were, again, I don't think it's fair to take any inference. If she saw him, like, whispering furiously or, you know, evidence of some conflict, I don't think that's something to be taken into account. Obviously, when you appear in court and you have a client with you, there people may observe or make inferences based upon what they see. But I don't think that's legitimate because these are private conversations and private interactions between counsel and the defendant. So what the judge did was essentially penalize Mr. Mitchell for counsel of choice and for privileged interactions with his attorneys. And she was very clear that this was a significant part of her decision. You use attorneys like Kleenex. You use them and you throw them away. And I admire her, you know, vigor of phrase. But regardless, that should not have been a factor factoring into a decision to send somebody to life in prison. Now, we do acknowledge that this must be addressed as plain error. It is error. It's clear error. It had a significant effect on the outcome because, as she acknowledged during her decision, it was a close case on whether the cross-reference had been proved by a preponderance, and I won't deal with that issue in detail unless it comes up. And it was a significant decision. And she made a very invidious inference. She said, you're obviously a manipulative person. You just try to overpower people. And a significant factor in her determining this was her perception that he was changing counsel or counsel couldn't get along with him or he can get along with counsel. And that shouldn't have been done. If I had been representing him early on and I had known this, I mean, I might have had to advise him and say something like, you know, even though you don't get along with me, you better not change me, because later on some judge is going to say you're a manipulative, you know, SOB, colloquially, and might hold that against you. You know, unless there's some actual event which is on the record, demonstrable, something the judge could consider, the judge shouldn't have considered these private interactions and his constitutional right to either choose different counsel or his counsel's right to at some point say, not the case for me, not the client for me, I need to withdraw. So for all of those reasons, Your Honor, this case should be reversed and remanded for a new sentencing hearing at which the trial judge or a different trial judge is instructed not to take this into account and to reconsider the issue of whether this man should spend the rest of his life in prison. I will note that if you are the only disagreement I think I have on the facts with Appellee is Appellee says that she was looking at outward behavior. She couldn't have been looking at outward behavior for the times when she wasn't the trial judge. So she's really looking at entries on a docket sheet, which are, as far as we know, proper exercises of everybody's rights. The right of counsel of choice is one of the most important rights there is. As I began to say earlier, it's error, it's clear error, affected the proceedings, and on the fourth part of the plain error test, it does in fact affect the integrity and fairness of the proceedings. It's not really an issue of effective assistance of counsel. We're not contesting that Bratton was effective. It's a question of whether Mr. Mitchell's right to choose attorneys and his attorney's right to choose him or not choose him was used as a factor in sentencing. It's a significant, powerful right. Under Gonzales-Lopez, it's one of those rights that is structural and mandates reversal even in the absence of a showing of prejudice. In this context of plain error, we don't deny that prejudice must be shown, but we think it has been shown. And for those reasons, we ask for a reversal. If there are no further questions, I will reserve.
I just want to just look at the murder cross reference. The murder cross reference.
Yes.
The standard is preponderance.
Correct.
I guess that's what one of the things you were challenging as far as. Is that the proper standard, right?
I did, Your Honor.
I know we have precedent. It was an unargued case. I just wondered, beyond that, I'm not real familiar with that, but it seems pretty significant in this case.
Well, Your Honor,
you say that because of not getting along with his attorneys, you look at external stuff, but that seems like a pretty bigger external issue if you're involved in a murder, and that goes into your sentence.
Well, to address this issue briefly in two parts. One issue is, is this a tail wag the dog case, and has the tail wagging the dog doctrine been discarded by this court? I believe one concern was that the opinion that discarded it, Justice Posner's decision, involved a case which was an Anders brief where nobody argued it, and the counsel said, I need to withdraw because even if the standard were changed, there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So I don't think the issue has actually been really addressed very specifically on point in a case where it mattered, and this is one case where it does matter. Second, as to whether the preponderance standard was met in this case, my brief contains arguments as to the trial judge's misperception, which I believe is echoed by the appellee's brief, as to what the actual facts were, because the critical thing she relied on was these interactions between Heather Clark, Raleigh Mitchell, and Billy Hicks. But if you look carefully at the record, you'll find Heather Clark doesn't know Billy Hicks. She only heard that the phone call was from Billy. She didn't know they were going to meet Billy Hicks. She never identified Billy Hicks. She never overheard a conversation in which the name Tony Hurd, the man supposedly murdered, was mentioned. She heard vague tidbits.
We know he was murdered, right?
Oh, absolutely he was murdered. But the question is, was that conversation between Raleigh Mitchell and some unknown person who might have been Billy Hicks a conversation about the murder? And if you look carefully at the record, as I've tried to do in my brief, you'll find that the trial judge, as well as the government, has leaped and made the evidence look better than it actually is. And for that reason, we don't believe that the burden of preponderance was met, particularly because the trial judge relied on that. She could have mentioned other things like the jailhouse informants or hearsay from the jailhouse informants, but she specifically said that that was questionable. It was vague. People weren't presented. The key fact for her was the Heather Clark testimony. And if you look, she misapprehended what the Heather Clark testimony actually was. So I'm not arguing this in detail. It's in the briefs. But we don't believe that it was proved beyond preponderance. Even if not, it demonstrates how close the evidence was and how significant it was in her decision, her perception of Mr. Mitchell's conflicts with his attorneys.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Richards. Mr. Brookman, for the government.
So, good afternoon now, Your Honors. My name is Matt Brookman. I'm an assistant United States attorney. Just turned, just past noon, by my watch anyways. Well, I guess it's... I was the trial counsel, and I was also the counsel at sentencing in this case. And I'm asking the court to affirm the sentence that was imposed by the district court on Mr. Mitchell. The court correctly applied the preponderance standard to the guidelines calculations. In doing that, the Reuter case made clear that the law of the land, the law of this circuit at least, was that the preponderance standard applied to those calculations and to those determinations. Having done so, the court was presented with abundant evidence to conclude that by a preponderance of the evidence that Mr. Mitchell had participated in the murder of the informant in his case, Tony Hurd, and then correctly applied the murder cross-reference to the guidelines calculation. The court didn't stop. That, of course, resulted in a level 43 criminal history 4, which resulted in a guidelines range of life in prison. The court didn't stop there. It carefully considered the 3553 factors, noted the defendant's extensive criminal history, noted the facts of the case that the defendant was a major drug distributor in his area, in his community, noted the what it called the dreadful or disturbing facts of the murder of the informant in order to hide or to prevent prosecution of the case. And based on all those things, the court carefully considered the 3553 factors and concluded ultimately that the guidelines range of life was in fact a fair and appropriate sentence in this matter. Of course, a sentence within the guidelines is presumed appropriate, and the court stayed within the guidelines here. I would dispute the appellant's characterization that the key factor that the court relied on in determining that the cross-reference applied was the testimony of Heather Clark. While I would submit that Ms. Clark's testimony regarding taking Raleigh Mitchell to meet with Billy Hicks was an important piece of the puzzle, this was a sort of a circumstantial case to some degree on the murder cross-reference, and that was just one piece of the puzzle. And I don't believe that, in my careful review of the record, that the court gave any particular significance to Heather Clark's testimony over any of the other testimony that was presented to the court at sentencing. I would note that defense counsel conceded that Heather Clark and Raleigh Mitchell met with Billy Hicks. So there was no issue before the court as to whether or not it was Billy Hicks who they were meeting with when she drove Mr. Mitchell to meet with Hicks after the murder, and they discussed people getting paid who were responsible for making the murder occur. So that wasn't an issue. The defense counsel conceded that they met with Hicks. There was never any dispute.
He conceded that they talked about paying people to pay them for the murder.
He didn't concede that they were talking about people paying for the murder. He drew a different inference from the conversation, but he never disputed that the conversation was between Billy Hicks and Raleigh Mitchell and that Heather Clark had taken them there and overheard the conversation. So factually speaking, there was no issue with whether or not Raleigh Mitchell had met with Billy Hicks in this conversation, this post-murder conversation. With respect to the Sixth Amendment argument, Your Honors, I don't believe that in my research I could find nowhere where this sort of conduct would amount to a violation of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. The Constitution guarantees that a defendant have counsel at all meaningful stages of the criminal process. It guarantees that, certainly when you're hiring your own counsel, that you have a right to a choice of counsel. Mr. Mitchell was never denied counsel at any stage of the proceedings. He was denied, he was given his right to his choice of counsel twice. He fired one privately retained lawyer and then, Mr. Kamen, and then had Ms. Collada, Jennifer Collada, out of the Louisville area. Then he had appointed lawyers after that, court-appointed lawyers, and he was, in fact, allowed to fire one of those and have another, a second lawyer appointed.
Schrager.
That was Ed Schrager, yes, Your Honor, and then ultimately he had Mr. Bratton as his counsel at trial. And I don't believe, I'm not positive that Magistrate Foster handled all of those proceedings with respect to counsel. I think Judge Barker may have actually allowed Mr. Schrager to withdraw and appointed Mr. Bratton, but I could be wrong on that, Judge, but I don't have a...
It should be evident from the docket.
It should be in the docket. And another thing that I think should be in the docket also is that the court wasn't just looking at a docket sheet when it drew some conclusions about Mr. Mitchell and his character. Raleigh Mitchell was a letter writer to the court. He was a pro se motion filer to the court, even when he had counsel. He, on his own, would file motions. So he made his relationship and how he interacted with his counsel known to the court in a non-attorney-client privileged way. He chose to write letters to the court, and he chose to file his own motions, even when counsel were filing motions for him and representing him. And I think what the court was doing in its comments at sentencing about his relationship with counsel was two things. I think, first, the court was recognizing that Mr. Bratton had a tough job, and in some sense thanking him for that or acknowledging that he had done a tough job in getting this case to where it was. And then the other thing I think the court was doing was looking at different factors and coming to a decision about the defendant's character. The court never cared who the counsel was, never referenced any privileged communications. In fact, I think the court went out of its way to note that it wasn't relying on any secret information or any privileged sort of information in coming to this conclusion. But what Judge Barker had been able to do is through trial, through the pretrial proceedings, through the motion hearings, had a chance to see Raleigh Mitchell interact with his lawyer, had seen that Mitchell filed motions on his own where his lawyers, against his lawyer's wishes, and trying to seek to have different lawyers fired for what he perceived as conflicts. He was a difficult client. He attempted to manipulate the system, and the court picked up on that. And these were all indicative of his character. Of course, the defendant's character is something that the court can and should look to in deciding an appropriate sentence under the 3553A factors. So this wasn't a comment on his right to counsel. Rather, this was a comment on his character, as it was evidenced somewhat by his outward interaction with counsel that the court had observed over the course of this proceeding. I don't believe that rises to a Sixth Amendment violation. I could find no case in any court where that would arise to a Sixth Amendment violation. Based on all of the above, I would submit that the court did a very careful consideration of the guidelines and the facts leading to those guidelines. It reached a conclusion about the murder cross-referenced, which was legally and factually legally appropriate and factually supported. It made a very careful consideration of the 3553 considerations after that and decided under both the guidelines and under the 3553 considerations that the appropriate sentence in this case was life imprisonment. Frankly, I think it was a very concise and clear sentencing. It was fair. It was based on the law, and I think it should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Brookman. Rebuttal, Mr. Richards.
Just briefly, Your
Everybody
Honor.
Gets 2 minutes. So you get 2 minutes.
I think that's more than sufficient, Your Honor. Thank you very much. Just on a couple of points. First of all, I don't believe we're bound by defense counsel's concession or that the fact that he didn't want to argue that Billy Hicks was not the person. Obviously, the facts speak for themselves, not counsel. And in looking at the record carefully, she didn't identify Billy Hicks, didn't know Billy Hicks, didn't say that was Billy Hicks. All she knows is that a phone call came from Billy, and afterwards they met with a person in a car, and she overheard parts of a conversation. Second point, as to the characterization that the judge might have been relying on pro se filings or motions, she didn't say so. that she didn't make those. I don't think were made part of the record, but even if they were, she said, didn't say she was considering it. She did say she wasn't considering privileged matters, but she did say she was considering things she saw on the docket sheet. What she saw on the docket sheet was pure changes of counsel guaranteed by the Constitution. And if there are no further questions, I will conclude. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Richards. You also serve by court appointment.
No, I don't. I was retained, but I was retained, so I don't deserve the court's thanks.
We have you listed. Well, in any event, we thank both counsel for helpful presentations on the case, and the case is taken under advisement.
Even if you were paid, you did a good job.
Thank you very much.
The court will stand in recess.